town meeting.
Yeah.
School story.
We're going to call to order the Senate Committee on Education Interim Committee.
And I'm calling to order the Interim Committee on House Education.
And we're going to do a quick introduction. We'll start with to my right. Since there's nobody over there, we'll start to my left. We'll harass my senator. There's not a senator over there. I'm the Senate Committee Chair.
Thank you for clarification.
Not a senator over there.
I'll get him, you guys.
Thank you for defending.
So we'll start over with my good co-chair of this joint committee.
Oh.
And you can and the other statement you want, too.
Thank you, Representative Doherty from House District 35, Tigard and Southwest Portland.
Representative Lou Frederick from House District 43, that's Lloyd Center, North and Northeast Portland.
I'm Senator Jeff Cruz, just a farmer from Southern Oregon, pretty much.
State Rep Carl Wilson, District 3, Grants Pass.
Carla Peluso, State Rep, District 50, the great city of Gresham.
Sarah Kelser, State Senator, Senate District 8, Corvallis and Albany.
Representative Susan McClain from House District 29 out in West Washington County.
And now we'll go to the representatives to my right. Yes.
Greg Barreto, State Rep, House District 58, Wallowa County, Union County, and part of Umatilla County.
Jeff Reardon, State Representative, District 48, Outer Southeast Portland, down into Happy Valley.
Sherry Springer, State Rep, House District 17, and since we're naming towns, I'm from Sile. I represent Lebanon, Waterloo, Sweet Home State, and Sublimity, Gates, Mill City, Lyons, Detroit, and Idana. Do I win?
Actually, you don't, because I can't go on mine.
Representative, you only win because I didn't name all of mine.
I did.
I know. And I'm Arnold Robin, Senate District 5, and I have too many to mention, but I have seven. I could do my seven counties before I get into the cities. But I start in Coos Bay, just south at the Charleston Bridge, and I go to 3rd Street in Tillamook and the whole west side of Tillamook Bay, and then over to Sheridan and Falls City in the valley. So parts of seven counties. And with that, I'd also, it's a special week, and we'll let Representative Doherty have a little statement before we get going.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. I don't know if any of you, of course, all you're celebrating this week, but this week is American Education Week, and it's always the week before Thanksgiving. And a lot of people don't realize that American Education Week, which honors teachers, administrators, parents, substitutes, educators, or classified, everyone in the education field, was actually, the talks began in 1919. Between the National Education Association and the American Legion. And the reason was, as the draftees during World War II or World War I, 25% of them were illiterate, and 9% of them were so malnourished they had a lot of difficulty performing their duties as soldiers. So they got together, formed American Education Week, and the purpose is to celebrate public education to honor individuals who are making a difference for children. And so the first American Education Week was in 1921. So this is, I think, very appropriate, but this is our week.
And with that, we'll have our latest joining member introduce himself.
Oh. Thanks, Arnie.
You're welcome.
You gave me caught me on my feet here. All right. Senator Herman Bertschinger, District 2, which is Grants Pass and North Jackson County.
So with that, we are going to have two in this group, just so people understand. So we're going to have two presentations to the joint committees, and then the Senate committee will retire to just down the hall to Senate. I think we're in C?
B.
B. No, we're in B. To B for the last half when we are separated. But we have two short hearings today, informational. And the first one, so we will open an informational hearing on early intervention and early childhood special education update. And so those who are going to speak can come on up to the dais and start that presentation. And I do want to thank, you know, he's not part of this, Ozzie Rose sitting in the back for helping get this organized. So thank you, Ozzie.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairs Roblin and Doherty. Thank you very much for having us here this morning. I think, actually, Senator Roblin, the fishing grounds that you cover means that you might win.
That's right.
Unprecedented, I have to say. It's a pretty impressive fishing area. At any rate, thank you all very much for taking the time to allow us to present to you this morning on early intervention, early childhood special education. For the record, I'm Rob Saxton, Superintendent of the Northwest Regional ESD. Wow, I almost reverted to old titles. Superintendent of the Northwest Regional ESD. And it's great to be here this morning. So we are going to talk about early intervention, early childhood special education, also known as EI, ECSE. So either of those two things I hope will suffice as we talk today. And we're going to talk about the programming and the funding that we find right now with EI, ECSE. So if you could this morning, I know it's a little bit early, but if you could just for a moment with me imagine that either you or your children have just had a new infant, your baby or your grandchild, or maybe it's a niece or a nephew brand new to this world, and it's such an exciting, incredible time in your life, and you have such hopes and dreams and beliefs about this child, and there's so much incredible love that you feel for this baby. And then you start to watch them grow, and you go visit other family members, or you go to your play group for the first time, and you recognize that the other babies are smiling, but yours hasn't. And you know that maybe that could be a sign of autism. Or you notice that some of the other babies are beginning to crawl and yours is not. And you wonder if there is some other kind of possible delay. And so you go and you have them evaluated and you find out that indeed there is some kind of a delay. And you are referred so that you can go get some support from early intervention, early childhood special education. One of the things that you know, or that you'll learn as soon as you're referred, is that the brain development that occurs in the first 4 years of a child is the primary brain development time. That 90% of our brain is formed up by age four. And that with really great intervention, there's an opportunity, the best opportunity that this child, who you care so dearly about, is ever going to have to get as much possible brain development as they're going to achieve as quickly as possible, their best opportunity to make the best gains that they're going to experience over the entire course of their lifetime is right now. And if you can meet with some people who can tell you a little bit about how to interact with your child in the most effective way so that you can stimulate that brain development, or if they can begin to interact with that child in a way that will stimulate that brain development and help overcome either the delay or the disability as best as possible, you have a great opportunity for the child to have the best hope for success over time. And when you go and meet with people, what you find out is that you're going to get 2.5 hours of service per month. Per month. Because honestly, that's exactly what we're doing right now in the state of Oregon. We're identifying children in this state who have a delay, that we know have a delay, that we know that our best opportunity to have them prepared to be successful, the best opportunity that we have to intervene and work with their parents so that they can help their child be as successful as possible, is right now during this 4 or 5 year time frame. And we give them 2.5 hours of service per month. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the program that we have in place. We want you to know what EI, ECSE is. We want you to know what EI, ECSE does for children. We want you to understand what the recommended service level is, a service level that was recommended by our legislature through a committee process. We also want you to know what parents and children actually receive and what kinds of issues that brings to our youngest children who we want desperately to make sure are going to be prepared to be successful in kindergarten, who need to be part of our 40-40 solution, because 40-40-20 is everybody. And that if we don't appropriately fund this, we cannot get there. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to people who are more expert about EI, ECSE, and I'll let them introduce themselves. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Judy Newman, and I'm a member of the State Interagency Coordinating Council and also a co-director of Early Childhood Cares, which provides services to in early intervention, early childhood special ed. My job today is sort of the meat and potatoes to tell you what this is all about and hopefully bring some of the information to light. Thank you, Rob, for setting the context so meaningfully. So what do early intervention and early childhood special ed services really look like? And how do you actually provide special education to children before they actually start school? We know that we know what it looks like in schools, but it's very different with this age group of children under 5 years of age. And because they spend their time at home, they spend their time in child care, and they spend their time in preschool. It begins with a referral to EIECSC programs. A child may already have a diagnosed disability, or they may have a suspected disability or developmental delay. Anyone can really make a referral to these services. So if a child enters with a completed developmental screening, which many children do now, that screening's reviewed for further action. And if a child does not enter with a completed developmental screening, they receive one upon referral. Based on this information, the results from the screening, a more complete developmental assessment may be recommended, provided, and eligibility determined. This is done usually in a familiar place for the child, in their home, in their child care setting, or in a preschool. For most parents, this is a very scary time, as you can imagine, as you're going through all of these steps of the process. And I just want you to know that it's done with great sensitivity and respect for parents. After that, an IFSP or an individualized plan is developed in partnership with the child's parents. Now, this plan is like a roadmap, and it shows where the child is now and what they need to learn next and what their parents need to help them become better parents and help their child learn to grow and develop. It identifies what services and supports are needed to achieve these goals, how much is needed, who will provide them, where this will happen, and most often the services are provided in natural environments for children or with typical peers if they're preschool age. Then the services and supports begin, and the progress is monitored on a regular basis. Now, this sounds like a lot, and it really is. There's a lot of steps involved getting kids into the program. But it's important for you to know that all of this is completed within 45 calendar days for children under the age of 3. And for kids over the age of 3, they only have 60 days to get that child into services. So this is a very, very strict requirement, and it's monitored. So this happens in a timely manner. So the development and implementation of the IFSP is a dynamic process and a team effort for parents and family members, teachers, and professionals involved with the child. All this planning together is to ensure the child continues to learn and develop, and the parents get the skills and support they need to help their own child. What is a recommended service level, you might ask? So many programs that you're familiar with have required service levels. So when you think of Head Start, they have a certain number of days and hours that they have to have kids in school. When you think of Healthy Families Home Visiting Program, they have required caseloads. They can't go over these maximums. But for early intervention, early childhood special ed, that's not the case because services are really supposed to be individualized. But some guidance really is needed and helpful. So a group of experts, at the request of the legislature several years ago, a group of experts in EIECSC from various disciplines reviewed the literature and the research, and they identified guidelines for what constitutes an adequate service level for children to progress and close the developmental gaps in these early years. In this process, they consider children of various levels and needs and various ages. After all, one size, as we know, doesn't fit all, and dosage is very, very important to making progress. So, Children with low needs, let me describe what that looks like. We looked at kids with low needs, and we sort of defined them. You can see the developmental areas up there. They usually have delays in one or two areas. So some examples would be kids with communication disorders or mild cerebral palsy or maybe just social communication needs. Then we're looking at children with moderate needs, and they have developmental delays documented in three or four developmental areas. And these can be children like that have Down syndrome or children with autism spectrum disorder that are functioning pretty well. And then children with high needs have developmental delays in all areas to a very significant degree. They often have sensory impairments and multiple problems. These are children with autism spectrum disorder and really high behavior needs, children with various genetic orders, disorders, for example. So parents with that have children at all these ages and at all these levels of involvement, they're always considered important. And really a big job of ours in early intervention, early childhood special ed, is to work with families, because that's our very best investment in parent education. Because, you know, after all, they're with their kids more time, and they're with their kids over the long haul. They're going to be the best support and advocate for them. So what are the issues? We need to help each child be ready for kindergarten. For children eligible in EI-ECSE, this means we need to help kids close the developmental gap, and in some cases, they actually catch up to their typical peers. And we always want to minimize the negative impact of any kind of developmental delay or disability. In order to do this, we need to ensure there is sufficient funding to provide the adequate service levels recommended by experts and research. This is not happening. Service levels have been gradually declining due to increases in eligible children and funding that has not kept pace with the growth in costs and numbers. This has largely happened because, unlike any other program, early intervention, early childhood special ed cannot have a wait list. So everyone who is identified, whenever they are identified in that short timeline, must be served. This is both a great asset, I think, to this program, and also a great challenge. You'll hear parents talk about early intervention, early childhood special ed programs as being their life support. Probably many of you have heard parents in these hearings. They learned how to help their child, and how child care providers and preschool children could include their child in those settings. And they've established trusting relationships with their service provider. But you know what you'll also hear from these same parents? That even despite the valuable help, that they really need more time, more home visits, more services. It's not enough, really, to meet the need. So the data speaks for itself. Only 30.4% of early intervention children, those are the birth to three-year-old kids, received adequate services. And I'm just highlighting 2014. You can see the trend if you look in the slide. 61.1% of early childhood special ed age kids with mild delays received the service levels they need. Now, that's our best number, but it's still just a little bit over half the kids getting that adequate level. Only 6.9% of ECSE children in the moderate category received adequate services. And lastly, 1.4% of ECSE children in the high needs category received adequate services. If you think back to Rob's example of this being your child or your grandchild, you know, how would you be feeling if you saw these numbers? So we've been tracking service levels in EI-ECSE across the state for over 10 years. From between 2004 and 2011, early intervention services decreased by 66.7%, and early childhood special ed services have decreased by 43.3%. This is really not acceptable. We do not expect this situation to improve either. What? Yes.
I don't follow that last chart quite.
This one?
Yeah. Is it the 18.6 per month? Is that
that's the average kids get? Receive? Yes. Okay. Which was a decrease of 66.7% over that time period.
Okay.
So 7 years ago, they were getting 66.7% more time.
That's an issue. But we really are awake up here, by the way.
Yeah. Okay. Does that make sense to you now? Thank you. So we don't expect this to get better without increased funding, because we're already identifying children at a higher rate than projected this during this biennial budget. So the budget was built this year on a projection of 2.18% growth rate. And in November this year, which isn't even 6 months into this biennium, we're identifying kids at 3.33%. So that's a much higher rate already, and we anticipate that getting larger, because we attribute much of this to the accelerated growth rate because of the state CCO incentive target to screen all children under the age of 3. So there's already been a marked increase, and we know the number is going up. In my program alone, last year, in 1 year, we increased 10% over the year before in EI age kids that were eligible. That's a huge increase. So this is also great. We should be identifying kids as early as possible and getting them help. But we also must ensure that adequate help is there for them.
Thanks, Judy. Hi, I'm John Rexford. I'm the superintendent of the High Desert Education Service District in Central Oregon. We're also the regional early childhood contractor serving Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson counties, and work with partners in Harney as well as Sherman, Gilliam, and Wheeler counties. I'm also a recovering K-12 superintendent. I was a deputy superintendent, served 23 years with Ben Lapine Schools. And I can really see the downstream impact, the difference we make with these kids at this age, and what we can do with them once we get them into the K-12 system is profoundly impacted by the services they receive in EIECSE. For me, this is a simple challenge. Restricted funding over the last decade has led to declining service levels. Judy illustrated that clearly. The rise in developmental screening is sharply increasing our caseloads, and so I just want to share a couple of charts that bring that back home. Funding per child has fallen behind rising costs. Over the last 5 biennia, we've been essentially flat with a little bit of a bump in this most recent biennium. I call your attention to the shortest blue bar there. You see that in 2011-13, we had a tough time making ends meet and serving children. In our region, it meant we cut 20 days of services to kids in that biennium to meet the budget restraints that we had. I want to talk a little bit about the rolling average that we use to mark our enrollment. Because of the dramatic but regular variation in students over a year, starting in September and rising usually through August, when we exit another cohort into kindergarten, we use a rolling average to track the number of kids. And that does a great job of stabilizing funding, making sure we smooth the ups and downs, and it really works well in a stable environment. But what it does do in a sharply increasing environment is really suppress the growth rate over a month. So if we have 5% more kids in a month, just a 12th of that gets added to our rolling average, and we are in fact facing that. Even under that scenario, you see that our rolling average for the last 2 months, and now a number that I didn't get into the chart, for 3 months, our rolling average has really started to blow through the estimate from the Legislative Fiscal Office. I wanted to just dive down into that a little more and look at some year-over-year growth. So this looks at last October and the number of kids that we have this October, and look at that increase. In red, you'll see in calendar 2014, we're actually very flat. In fact, we had several months of negative growth. That is, we had a few fewer kids to serve in a given month over the year before. But you'll see, beginning in December, the last one on the right, the last red bar on the right, we started to see that effect of that increased developmental screening. And in fact, every month since February, we've exceeded the estimate from the Legislative Fiscal Office for increases in this coming year. And we are just blowing through it in the most recent months at a rate 2 to 3 times of what that rolling average projects. We think that is going to lead to at least an additional 700 kids in the biennium.
And that doesn't seem like many when we're looking at over 500,000 K-12 kids, or in this case, 20-some thousand kids served over the biennium. But it turns out to be real money and real impact to the services of the children that we're serving in our programs. Once we translate that to budget implications, we estimated 23,477 students that we would serve in that biennium, so that's counting kids twice during the year, the 2 years. We think we're going to blow through that and serve an additional 700 kids to maintain the delivery of the minimum service level that we've been describing. It looks like we're going to need an increase in the budget of about $5.4 million in this biennium. The number is pretty clear, but the impacts, I think, are profound. I've got one more number that I'd like to share with you. I know that in our region that we serve in our early intervention program about 200 kids. Excuse me, about 400 kids, 200 kids. And of those kids, about 20% of them won't need further services. So we can make a difference. About 40 kids will not need further services after we've served them 0 to 3. That's 40 kids that won't need services next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. That is a lot of money that we don't need to put back into those kids. We've tuned them up, we've sent them on the way, but probably most importantly, we've affected the trajectory of their lives by just putting a little bit of service in the front end when it matters the most.
Hello, my name is Cassandra Trout. I hold many hats in this field, but most importantly, I am here today because I am a parent of a child with a very rare genetic disorder that has caused some significant impairments to his development. My son Ben, who you can see on the screen there, is now 5. Sorry. But our family began working with our early intervention program when he was only 2 months old. We found out very early that he would need help. Our service providers have worked with us every year to identify his current needs, which have always been very significant, and to ensure that we always knew the best strategies and techniques to help meet those needs. His early intervention team has been the foundation of our family's support system and has had a profound impact on his development. He finally learned how to walk after he turned 3 years old, but he finally learned how to walk. And he still cannot speak, but he's starting to respond to his name. And thanks to our local program that sent my husband and I to a training, he is starting to use picture exchange communication to communicate, which is huge. We have had zero communication up to this year. You know, we have all heard that the parent is the child's first and best teacher in these early years. And children learn so much by listening to us and watching us and interacting with us. But if you think about it, as a parent, what if you have a child who cannot hear you because he has a hearing loss or isn't watching you because he's more interested in his hands than anything else in the room or doesn't even want to make eye contact with you, let alone interact with you? What do you do? How do you help that child learn? For many families, we begin to lose hope. We don't know how to help. And that's what happened to our family. But early intervention and early childhood special education help to rebuild that hope by giving the families the tools they need to help their children succeed. Our specialists made a difference for Ben, not because of the short amount of time they were able to spend with him, but because of what they taught my husband and I. You know, as you heard earlier, in Oregon, of the children with the most significant needs, like Ben, he is delayed in every single area of his development. Less than 2% are actually receiving the service levels that are recommended by research and best practices and by the team of experts that the legislator put together to find out what those service levels should be. And funding has not kept pace with the new children being identified for services, and service levels have decreased substantially. You know, when I meet and speak with families whose children are now older but have been through early intervention or early childhood special education, I learn that they had received many more hours in services when their child was the same age. And I worry about Ben's future, and I worry about whether he's getting what he needs to develop to his full potential and be as independent as he can when he's older. Evidence shows that if we invest in these children now, when they are young, we save so much when they go to the formal K through 12 schooling. Oregon has invested in early intervention and early childhood special education in order to change the lives of these children and families. So we need to actually invest enough to be able to provide the service levels that are going to be effective in making those changes. Thank you so much.
So just a quick summary, and I think you've heard this, but I do think it's important for you to hear it sort of in short order. And that is that we currently have an inadequate level of service. And the legislature convened a committee. They identified the appropriate levels of service. 30.4% of children in early intervention get that level of service. 64.1% of those who are identified with low needs get the level of service identified. 6.9% of children with moderate needs get that level of service, and only 1.4% of children with high needs get the level of service that you yourself have identified as appropriate. The state is spending huge amounts of money right now to ensure that we're doing a good job around early childhood and with coordinated care in the state, and they are doing more screening than they've ever done before so that we can identify these children as early as possible, which means that the numbers of children that we're, because we're screening more, we're identifying so many more children who need these services and who will benefit from them as they move forward and become a K through 12 child or K through 12 student. And yet we haven't increased the funding level to keep up with the additional identification. So we're identifying more kids and we don't have anything to give them. There are no waiting lists in EIECSE. Children must be served. And so all that we do when we have more children and no more money in an already inadequate service level is thin the soup to a point that there's no nutrition for anyone in the soup. And we end up really not giving any child what it is that they need. We've identified $5.3 million as our ask. That would be an ask that would keep up with the level of service, the inadequate level of service that we're already currently providing. If we're going to provide more service to the children who are identified in the program, it's going to take more than 5.3. We're asking for 5.3 because we're told that there isn't a whole lot as you head into the February session. Obviously, we think that more than that would do a better job. Every day in my new job, I hear from superintendents who come to the ESD and say, Rob, when are you going to start up some early K-12, so kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, programs for students that would be behavior programs? Because we've got kids who are showing up in kindergarten, first, mm-hmm. second, and third grade that are different than anything we've ever seen before. We've got educators, both teachers and classified, who are being hurt on a regular basis as they try to work with these children, different than we've ever seen before. And we've got to figure out how that we're going to deal with this, and you've got to start some programs for us. Those programs are super expensive. And part of the reason that we need to put those programs in place is because we're not doing the job in EIECSE. Mm-hmm. And we can do the job in EIECSE. We have every mechanism in place. All we need is a little bit of a bump in resource so that we can put that mechanism to work the way that we need to put it to work. And so that's a significant concern. The last thing that I want to share with you, and it's not something that is the right reason. The right reason is because we have kids and parents who need this, and it is a good downstream investment for the state of Oregon to take care of these kids when brain development is its highest. It's the right thing to do by them. But the other thing I want you to know is that when I was the deputy superintendent here in the state of Oregon, I spent 3 years, the entire 3 years that I was in that chair, across from a group of people at least this many that flew out from Washington, D.C. once a month to sue the state around the services that we were providing to children with special needs. And it had to do with the sheltered workshops and the transition services that we gave to kids from the time that they went to high school out into the world of work. And the U.S. government sued us in Lane v. Kitzhaber and then Lane v. Brown. And we finally settled that lawsuit this last summer. And it was very expensive for the state of Oregon, way more expensive than what I'm talking about here today. You have identified a service level that you're not meeting. I do not understand, in one of the most heavily litigated areas of education, in fact, the most heavily litigated areas of education, that the state of Oregon has not been sued on this issue yet. It is simply a matter of time. And the 5.3 that we're asking for is nothing compared to the lawsuit that we are destined to lose as a state, because we haven't done the job providing the level of resource that is required to meet the needs of these children. And it will be something that we will need to see happen if we cannot get this level of service taken care of for kids. Thank you. Be happy to answer questions.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank you all for the presentation. The first time I ever came into this building and participated in anything, I sat in exactly the chair that Cassandra is sitting in and had next to me my four-year-old, who was in early intervention, early childhood special ed services. It may have been a sign that he then walked out the door and threw up in the hallway. But we came back anyway. He, like your son, was identified as delayed in every single area. And it's shocking to me now to listen to my constituents talk about the services that they receive. And I went back to look at his services. He got speech with a speech therapist at home once a week for 30 minutes as a toddler. Also, twice a week for 30 minutes at home, services with a physical therapist. Twice a week, services at home with an occupational therapist. Twice a week at a school, a speech and motor group. And then once every other week, a services coordinator, a special educator, came to consult with me and help talk to me about my nonverbal child. How did I point out to him what he was seeing in the world, and letters, and all of these things that he couldn't talk about. I know that now, as a kid who's 21 and talking about who he wants to go out with on his 21st birthday, that set the stage for where he was at, for the things that make his life good, reading. He reads history books. He reads Gregory Maguire all the time. He rides his three-wheeled bicycle. All of those were things that EI set the foundation for. And then a couple of years ago, in what I think was a very concrete example of why these services are so important, he was having a different medical problem. We saw a physician who did this assessment of him and testing reflexes and all these other things. And he said, oh my gosh, this kid must have had really good and consistent physical therapy services when he was a child, because it makes no sense to me why he can walk. He would not have had access to those physical therapy services if it were not for early intervention and early childhood special ed, because you cannot go out and buy them. It is not covered by insurance, so unless you have the ability out of pocket to pay for a physical therapist who does not exist in your community to provide those services, the child doesn't get the services, and the impact is very, very real. So we talk about the kids, the importance of that investment in the kids that come in and they get the tune out and they move back. I would argue that investment in kids like Ben and Sam really pay off in the long run. And I know that those are the skills that are going to help Sam meet the goals that we've just settled in that lawsuit, to go out to be able to work independently in the community at a competitive wage. For the kids that we talk about that are in behavior programs in our schools that are really struggling, these are kids that are trying to communicate something. What if when they were in early intervention and nonverbal, we had given them the tools to communicate what they needed to do so they didn't need to flail and hit and do things that are very difficult to manage just because they're trying to communicate something? These are investments that pay off across the board, and I'm just so grateful. And to Cassandra, it's great to see the pictures of Ben. And when I think back to, to my time as the parent of a five-year-old entering kindergarten, I sometimes wish I could have looked ahead to see this young adult that's with me now, and to know it's all going to be okay, and not just okay, but really fantastic. So stick with it. There are only really, really great things ahead.
Any other questions? Quickly, so.
Well, if it's quickly, then never mind. I was going to tell you a short story, but never mind.
I just want to say thank you. It sets the stage for us to have real conversations at the legislature. And Cassandra, we assume that you'll be sitting up here in a little while. So, again, thank you very much for a very, very well done presentation to give us an understanding. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll close our informational hearing, however it goes, and we will open a public hearing information session on culturally responsive pedagogy and practices initiative presentation. And you guys can come on up, whoever's going to do the presentation, and we'll have them introduce themselves. And I want to say that Representative Doherty and I went to Teaching with a Purpose conference up in Portland. We didn't stay the whole time because we had other kinds of things, but we're exceedingly impressed with the presentations that were made at the beginning of that to set the stage. And I, we both agreed at that time that we wanted to have a meeting and have people hear a little bit about what's happening in a conference that has begun in the Portland area and is now reached, if you listen to the people who identified where they came from, people all over the country, and we are excited about that. So with that, we'll have introductions. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair Doherty and Chair Roblin and Joint Education Committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to come and share our work with you today. My name is Tanya Lubis, and I'm a professor and director of the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices at Eastern Oregon University. Today we're going to share with you the work that we have done as a result of House Bill 3233, which was set to establish a network of quality teaching and learning and was passed in 2013. This piece of legislation led to an establishment of grants through the Oregon Department of Education and the Oregon Educational Investment Board to fund projects centered in culturally responsive pedagogy and practices and focused on the Oregon equity lens. The Teaching with Purpose Conference and Teaching with Purpose Institute, as well as the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices, were just two of the funded initiatives. Today, we'd like to share with you some of the information about this work and how it should be leveraged in order to support the equitable educator and diversifying teacher education plans. The work we'll present reinforces the power that equitable education can have in changing the educational climate that oppresses ethnic and linguistic diverse students and fails to recognize the contributions that all students are capable of making in order to foster a future that elevates the value of all members of society. Specific details about the background, history, and linkage to current initiatives can be found in the concept paper that you've all been given this morning. And there is also detailed information about our projects, including testimonials that is available via the OLIS link. This morning, I'd like to start by sharing with you the work of the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices at Eastern Oregon University. This was established in order to provide a network of professional development for pre-service teachers and P20 educators in Eastern Oregon. The center serves as a resource center on materials for culturally responsive pedagogy and practices and provides professional development through strong partnerships with local school districts, charter schools, and educational service districts. And it is led by internationally acclaimed scholars who specialize in culturally responsive research and practices. The center also houses the Oregon Teacher Pathway Program, which is a pipeline program to recruit and retain ethnic and linguistic diverse teachers into education. The center is grounded in the belief that everyone has the ability to learn and achieve and has the right to be provided optimal learning environments that are responsive to their cultural and linguistic needs. As the educational landscape changes and we see more culturally and linguistic students in our classrooms, it's important that our teachers are prepared to meet their needs and foster success. However, these environments cannot happen without specific professional development and training for educators. This kind of training is that which we provide at the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices and the work that Karanja will talk about shortly. The goal of creating strong continuity between home and school and increasing student success is what we're looking for. With the help of grant funding last year, the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices was able to reach and form strong partnerships with educational agencies in 5 counties in Eastern Oregon. 198 educators across P20 roles were reached through the center's actions to date. This includes over 50 teachers and administrators from partner school districts, 40 members of EOU's faculty and staff, 59 undergraduate and graduate teacher candidates, and 48 Oregon Teacher Pathway students. Many other educators from around the nation have also participated in our work through the live streams and discussions available on our websites. The center serves as a model for culture-responsive practices and programming and has been recognized as a best practice that can lead to the development of culture-responsive education. This is work that should be replicated across the state of Oregon and colleges of education, and will place Oregon on the map as a leading in the critical work necessary to facilitate significant change in our educational systems. With continued support, the EOU Center can maintain and be sustained and have a strong model that will foster the development of replicated programs across the state. And I'd like to close the segment by sharing one of the 11 testimonial letters that we received in the last week. While each of the letters within the packet on OLIS is very strong and does impact, provide the impact of the work we're giving, I have chosen a letter to share with you that was written by three of our local high school students. And the letter is as follows. Dear Legislative Education Committee members, we were the students in the Oregon Teacher Pathway Program through Eastern Oregon University at McLaughlin High School in Milton Freewater, Oregon. Last year, as part of the course, we were given the opportunity to see some amazing scholars in the field of culturally responsive pedagogy. 50% of the student body at our school is of color, with the majority of those being Latino. Very few of us have had teachers that reflect our ethnic and linguistic diversity. It's been a struggle to feel empowered, respected, and heard in our classes. The first speaker we saw was Dr. Geneva Gay. Her talk was so inspirational and made us look critically at the education we were receiving from our teachers. We felt that the information she shared about how to become more culturally responsive was a message our teachers needed to hear. We organized a lesson on cultural responsiveness for our teachers. All of us took our own time after school to work with our teachers during a staff meeting. The results were amazing. We were able to give them specific examples of how they can improve their teaching and communication strategies and help us feel more welcome in their classrooms. They were able to see where their curriculum was leaving out our history and our accomplishments. After that staff training, we started seeing small changes and were very excited. The other speakers were just as motivating. We know that only a handful of our teachers from our school participated in training at the Center for Culture Responsive Practices at EOU, but the message is reaching a bigger audience. Our hope is that there are future speakers so that more of us can hear her message and hear what a responsive and equitable education looks like. Sincerely, Oceana Cook, Rigo Ponce, and Giselle Flores. At this time, I'll turn the remaining portion of the presentation over to my colleague, and we will answer questions at the end. Thank you again for your time.
First, I want to thank our chair, Senator Roblin, and Representative Doherty for this opportunity to come speak before you all. My name is Karanja Cruz. I am an educator in Portland, Oregon. I've been a teacher for 12 years. I would have to say I've been an effective teacher for 12 years because I teach with a mindset, what I teach with a purpose. And what that means is I teach to empower. I teach to empower my students. I started out in the Beaverton School District, and I finished my career in the Portland Public School District. And the reason why I want to say I started out in Beaverton, because my first 4 years was in a predominantly affluent white community. And when we talk about culturally relevant pedagogy and responsiveness, I had to become that. Me being from Northeast Portland and being in an environment that's not an affluent community, I was able to easily adapt because I built relationships with my students. And that's what I want to talk to you guys about today. So culturally relevant pedagogy and practice, the request for funding. So first of all, I want to start out by stating this work is very important to me, and it touches home because my children, my two children that you see here, and this is Aaron, they attend one of the lowest performing schools in the state. And I want you guys to take a moment and look at these statistics. So over 57% of the population demographic.
You don't have to get that close to the mic. It'll pick up. So you're good. Just relax.
57% of the students, but they make up 83% of the total discipline referrals. 73% of the black students did not meet reading benchmark. 85% did not meet math benchmark. And I want you guys to take a moment, because there's people behind these numbers. They're not just statistics. And this is happening on the day-to-day. I want you guys to all save the date. If you have a pen, please save the date for January 15th. We're going to have a state of the emergency success of black children. And this is centered and based around the new policy that you guys all passed, which is called House Bill 2016, the African American Success Plan. We're also going to be presenting later this afternoon before their advisory committee. But we're going to have a town hall at Boise Elementary School, basically to talk about the type of success plan that we could have for the African-American students at this particular school. Also, save the date for the next 7th Annual Teaching with Purpose Conference. That's going to be held again at Park Rose Middle School. We're going to have keynote speakers, Dr. Gloria Lassavillans, Tim Wise, and we're also going to have a number of national speakers and presenters that's going to be presenting. Now, let's get to the work. So Teaching with Purpose Conference. I started the Teaching with Purpose Conference in 2001 as a graduate student at Portland State University. During that time, it was a lot of protests that was happening within the community around the achievement gap. At that time, I was working with some student groups at Portland State, and we decided we wanted to have some type of action base. So we came together and we said, hey, let's come up with a conference and bring in experts around culturally relevant pedagogy and practice that can train teachers, teach administrators how to make their practice better. We were pretty successful. We brought in national speakers. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Bob Moses, a great civil rights icon. He was a keynote speaker, and we were able to draw over 150 educators during that time. I went into the classroom and became a teacher and began to teach with a purpose, so I wasn't able to have the time to be able to continue the conference. I started the conference back in 2011 as a 10-year anniversary, and we had a total of 11 teachers who attended that conference. 2012, I started the conference back again. We had a total of 15 teachers, and I was like, you know what, I need to step back because this work is too important and we need a greater number of educators attending this conference so we can help them better their practice. So I decided to take a leave of absence, and I focused my attention on growing the conference, and we went from 15 people to a total of 200 people in 2013. 2014, it grew to a total of 350 educators across the state, and this year it has grown to over 500 educators across the state. And I thank you again, Senator Roblin and Representative Doherty, for attending the conference this year, and hopefully more of you guys can attend next year. The goal of the conference is to activate equity-focused policy. Oregon is known for passing a lot of equity policy. However, the policy looks really nice on the shelf, but we need to focus on implementation of these particular equity policies. And that's what the Teach for a Purpose is driven to do. We also support and inspire leadership for culturally relevant pedagogy institutions and practices, and we also developed a network. So now we have a total network of educators across the state who are all wanting this type of work. They attend the conference because they want to better their practice. They attend this conference because they want to become better educators, and they want to be able to know how to better relate to their students across the board, across culturally backgrounds. So the annual Teaching with Purpose Conference, it educates and inspires and informs teachers and administrators, parents, students, and community organizers in Oregon and across the nation about the importance of culturally relevant pedagogy and practice. We were able to be able to have, to be the grant recipients of the grant that you guys all was able to funnel out through the House Bill 3233. And we were grant recipients, so we created the Teaching with Purpose Leadership Institute. What we did was we partnered with a total of 7 school districts, and they created leadership teams. The leadership teams made up of the superintendent. If the superintendent was not able to make it, it was another person from the district level leadership who attended these particular sessions. We also had a principal, a teacher, and a student, and also parents who made up their particular district team. And what we did was we looked at all the different equity policies that Oregon has. For example, Senate Bill 103, which is the multicultural education bill that was passed in 1999. There's a number of equity bills that we looked at, we analyzed, and we took those bills and we had them take their own equity policies and align their equity policies with our particular laws that we have in place. And to basically analyze and assess and see if we are in some type of compliance with these particular laws. Because again, the laws look pretty on paper, but we need to start figuring out and having a conversation how we can implement them effectively within the classroom. So the Leadership Institute, through the help of ODE and the grant funds that you guys helped to funnel through, we were able to increase the knowledge of Oregon equity laws. A lot of superintendents did not know about Senate Bill 103. A lot of superintendents do not know about House Bill 2016. A lot of superintendents do not have a lot of knowledge about these particular laws that you guys are passing. So we were able, number one, to increase the knowledge base about these particular laws. And then after we increased the knowledge base, we were able to assess their own equity policies and connect it to the particular laws. This work is extremely important. Policy into practice. What we're finding is that through all these different equity policies, there's no accountability. So, ODE submitted the Oregon Equity Access to Educator Plan, which was influenced by our U.S. Secretary of Education, who was asking state agencies to come up with some type of plan of how you are bringing about culturally relevant pedagogy and practice and how you are able to have excellent educators across the board. What Oregon, the ODE identified, they identified several gaps. One of the gaps was the recruitment and retainment of educators. One of the gaps also was the belief gap. Inadequate teacher preparation and attracting educators in rural and remote districts. But I want you guys to focus right now on the belief gap. This is what our Oregon Education Department identified as one of the high needs, a belief gap. What that is, basically, as a teacher, I have to believe in my students. I have to have a high expectations in my students. I have to believe, no matter what type of background they come from, I still have to have a high expectation and a belief in them that they can learn. And what we found is that the belief gap is extremely low. A lot of educators do not believe, I have that type of belief that all their students can learn and be effective. What we want to do is we want to help you all and help our state come out with a systematic process to ensure all agencies are following the same language of culturally relevant pedagogy and practice. Because across the board, if you ask this person, this person, this person, they all have different definitions. I want to work with you all to be able to come with a common language that we all can streamline and align with our own equity policies that we have. Take a look here. We have House Bill 32-33, which was the strategic funds that we were able to have, which was we were able to start the institute. We have Senate Bill 290, which is the teacher evaluation. The teacher evaluation law that you guys just passed has no equity lens attached to it. So if we're evaluating teachers, how are we going to evaluate them on their culturally relevant pedagogy and practice? And that's what we want to be able to help you guys with. Senate Bill 103, Multicultural Education. We have Senate Bill 739, which is the Multicultural Perspective in Oregon Studies. We have the House Bill 2192, which deals with the disproportion of discipline. We have House Bill 3375, which is able to bring more diverse teachers into Oregon. All of these are great policies. So what are we going to do about it? So I'm asking you that you help us continue our funding so we can be able to continue to work with these school districts to increase the knowledge of these particular equity laws and other laws that we have in place, put an equity lens behind it, for the culturally relevant pedagogy, language, and lens behind it, and let us continue to do our work because all of a sudden the funding was cut. I personally took a resign to be able to focus on this work, thinking that these funds are going to be renewed. No, that's not the case. Okay? So now, I still have my teacher license. I'm never going to lose that. I'm never going to give that away. But I'm here before you pushing this work with no funding. I have my son here because I started out. This is real for me because he actually, my kids attend a school, a low-performing school, attends a school that does not practice culturally relevant pedagogy and practice. So this is real to me. And he wanted to come and he wanted to say a few words. After we testify and after we say our words, we have a few educators, teachers, who are in the trenches, who are classroom teachers now, who wants to come and testify and be able to share with you their learning and how they've become empowered through the Teaching with Purpose Conference and through the trainings that we're providing. And then we're going to open up for questions. And hopefully you guys have a lot of questions to be able to ask us so we can be able to have a good dialogue. Mr. Aaron, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Aaron Cruz. I want to be an astronaut. But the work at my school is easy. My dad gives me hard work at home. But I want harder work at school. The books by teacher reads don't have black faces in the books that looks like me. Can you change this?
Thank you.
So hopefully that's the question that you guys can answer. At this time, we're going to have our educators come and say a few words, and we're going to come back and answer questions. Thank you. Just for a moment, let's go sit over there.
Chair Doherty and Chair Roblin, thank you so much for having us here. Members of the committee, thank you. I've submitted a written testimony, but I kind of wish to speak to you a little bit more directly today. I have been incredibly blessed.
Be sure and identify yourself. You need
Sorry. My name is Kevin Walker. I'm a sixth grade teacher at Fabian School in Northeast Portland.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been really blessed with a stable home, good upbringing, and a multitude of privileges. But a lot of my students, many of my 21 students at Fabian School in Northeast Portland, they do not have the same stable upbringing and privileges that I've had in my life. Currently in this state, 8% of the state teachers are teachers of color. 17% of the administrators are people of color, yet 36% of our student population are students of color and growing. And this is from the Oregon Department of Education report card, our state report, 2014-2015. As educators, we are systematically failing students of color. Almost twice as many black and Latino students drop out versus their white counterparts. In order to reach all students, we as a teaching force need relevant professional development to effectively reach all students. White teachers need to know how to be cultural brokers and culturally responsive in the classroom to raise all student achievement. The Teach with a Purpose Conference has equipped myself along with many other educators with tools to become culturally responsive teachers. Attending this event comes out of my home budget. I pay for this because I care about the outcomes of every student in my classroom and in order to do my job effectively. The Teach with a Purpose Conference provides this professional development that we can use in the classroom to ensure lower disparity rates between students of color and their counterparts. Culturally responsive teaching works. How many more students need to drop out or feel unsuccessful, or give up, before we can all agree that the way we are approaching educating our students of color, it just isn't working? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and Chair Roblin. It's nice to see you again, Chair Doherty. My name's Amy Havens, and you came and visited my classroom last year at Tuolumne Middle School. I would like to talk to you guys about being intentional in equity work. I intentionally decided to leave 16 years of experience in the Tiger-Tualatin School District to go work at Boise Elementary, Boise Elliott, so I could work with an underachieving school in a different demographics. I now have over 93% students of color in my fourth grade classroom. And I would like to note that we have been residing under this assumption that we're doing equity work all throughout the state. But I would also like to note that the data, the discipline data, the achievement data is not changing. So we need to look at what we're doing because it's not working. About 9 years ago, I started my equity journey in the Tiger-Tualatin School District. And I am here to say that not only does the data show that the change isn't happening, but the students' experiences in our schools across the state of Oregon, they're not changing. We need to do something different, and we need to be intentional about how we look at it. The Teaching with Purpose Conference is that something different. After attending the conference, I had an increased enthusiasm for the work that I have been in. I appreciated that there were people there besides teachers. There was administrators there. There were lawmakers there. There were community members. And I feel that we need this sense of collaboration among all of us to create the change that our students of color so desperately need. I also really appreciated the keynote speakers. There were well-published, highly recognized people in the world of equity that were presenting at the conference. Also, being a white ally in this work, you would think that I have a great amount of peers that I can relate to and get support from, but that hasn't been the case in my experience. I appreciated the conference giving me a group of educators that can become a support system. It really, really is encouraging when you look at equity work. Finally, my classroom was impacted immediately that Monday in regards to assessment. I created a framework for my students where kids could be more engaged in their education when they were given harder tasks. They showed more perseverance. And when you have fourth graders coming in stating, "Ms. Havens, is today the post-assessment day?" excitedly, then you know that you're on the right track. I would like to end with two stories that students in my classroom shared with me. These are fourth graders again. A student expressed to me that his mom was nervous about driving to Gresham to see family because of the KKK notes that were being left on vehicles. Another student expressed the sorrow that was happening in her home because of a shooting that happened just blocks from our school was her cousin. And although my first inclination is to acknowledge that in my whiteness, these students of color are able to explain to me the trauma that they endure on a daily basis, I get such a sense of urgency to also acknowledge that we need to do better, that we need to do better to understand the roles of these students, and that most importantly, I have to do the best I can do at educating them, the best I can with high expectations, so when they leave me, they're very competitive with their white counterparts, because right now that's not happening in our state. So I would ask you, Chair and Representatives, to be intentional with how you support funding for equity work. How do you allocate it? What resources do you support? And looking at conferences like Teaching with Purpose so we can make a difference. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, Chair Roland, and members of the committee. My name is Nadja Swalem. I'm a teacher at Centennial Park School in the Centennial School District. I teach high school language arts. I grew up in East Multnomah County, which was an extremely different place in the 1980s than it is today. My neighborhood was so white that me, like the fairest Arab in my family, was one of the only people of color in my school. I'm now a teacher in the Centennial School District, which is one of the East County schools whose student population is becoming increasingly more diverse, while the population of teachers remains predominantly white. While I have attended numerous conferences and taken culturally responsive teaching courses in my grad program previously, Teaching with Purpose focuses directly on you, your practice, and the empowerment of students of color. More than a conversation about race, Teaching with a Purpose is a call to action. It begs the question, how can we as educators meet students of color where they truly are, in their own schools and in their own neighborhoods? Because so often, we are looking outside of those areas to teach them in other places. So now, as a result of that, in my elective writing class, students are currently working on a guidebook to Portland Landmarks. we've been traveling around Portland and checking kind of a lot of places out, but what I realized after seeing Dr. Christopher Emden speak is that we need to focus on our community at hand. I realized that it was important to honor where students come from, and so we're now currently working on a local guide to restaurants within our community. As a first-generation Palestinian, I never saw myself in teachers, and I know that my students rarely see themselves in me. While I understand the first-generation experience, my skin color allows me privileges that many of my students will never experience. So I'm transparent with my students about this fact, and Teaching with a Purpose reminded me that my job is to inspire, teach, and create opportunities rather than hit students over the head with my white guilt. I will never truly understand what it is to walk in their shoes, but I can help guide them on a path of their choosing. And my job as an educator is to help students understand that their power is not only in education, but in telling their own truth. My colleague and I, who attended the conference with me, we were so inspired, and like I've already mentioned him once, we were so inspired by Dr. Christopher Emden that we brought a video of him and one of his lectures back to our school as part of our equity work. And we shared it as an in-service to start speaking about the ideas of reality pedagogy. We've taken his ideas to heart, and one of the things that he preaches is bringing your students in and allowing them to teach the class in a particular way, and that's something that we are planning on doing as well. And specifically also, S. Renee Mitchell's poetry session has also inspired our work, and we now begin our first period language arts classes by ciphering up and sharing in circles. And by doing so, we've created a stronger classroom community where students are more comfortable speaking from the heart, even when the subject matter is difficult. Teaching with Purpose impacted me in a way that I never expected. It changed the way that I think about and advocate for students, and not just students of color, but all students. Attending the conference helped me to realize how traumatized students are by our educational system. And while I knew our system was flawed, I didn't understand that it was not created truly for the betterment of people. And it's not about leveling the playing field. The playing field may never be level, but through transparency, discussion, and thoughtful, culturally responsive teaching, we as educators can work toward truly equitable practice. And I urge you to make it possible for more teachers to actually do this work and actually get the opportunity to go to this conference, because it has done really amazing things for the people who have been there and for the students. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions for this group? Okay.
No, you're good. You're good.
We're not excited.
Quick, too.
So, we would like to be your reporting agency. We want to report to you guys through town halls. We can come to Salem to be able to report on how culturally relevant pedagogy and practice is streamlining through the policies that you guys all pass. As you can see, the conference report that was just passed out to you, we have a total of 85% of teachers who attend the conference, 11% principals, 1% superintendents. We want to increase that number of superintendents. So we want to really focus on leadership. And we have a great opportunity because I have a lot of good relationships with COSA. I have a lot of relationships with the teacher unions. So we can leverage all these different relationships and be able to provide these different types of trainings to administration and let it trickle down all the way down to educators who we are majorly attracting, but we want to be able to attract those upper administration as well. So if you guys have any questions at this time, we can.
Any questions? Those. I do want to say, if you haven't gone, I think it is important for us to attend the conference. It was really good to hear the different keynote people at the beginning. I would love to have spent the whole day, but I had some other requirements. There were a few students. There was one young lady in particular who gave a recitation. It reminded me, my son was in debate, and there are different categories in debate, and she gave a speech which everyone should hear, and I couldn't do justice to it if I wanted to, but it really helps people consider where they come from in the context of this person explaining where she came from, and every educator should see it, because I think it was it really put a light on some things that would help people be more receptive to understanding why it's important to have culturally responsive pedagogy. And so I thank you very much for that. Lou?
Thank you, Chair. Hello again. We correspond on a regular basis, text messages, et cetera. But there's a real key element here that I think is important. We have had for 30 years one equity education bill or another come through this body. We have the real question is how what we do in terms of the next steps, taking the action, getting people there. You both have managed to bring folks together, and we need to have more folks coming together to do this kind of work. So I really want to thank you for that. It's also a matter of supporting it. We tend to do a short-term support, believing that somehow we've supported it and we don't need to do anything more. These two programs have been very, really effective, but they need to continue. Mm-hmm. So if we can find a way to do that, that's what we really need to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. And I was going to say, Aaron, I couldn't be an astronaut when I was younger because girls couldn't be astronauts. So things have changed, and I know they're all going to change for you, too.
Thank you.
Astronaut.
That's right.
In the 90s, we were concerned that when I was on the school board about increasing the pool of people of color that came into education. And is there anybody in charge of, in the state, in charge of increasing whose job it is to increase that number of candidates?
Sure. Not just one person. There's a team of folks that are working on just that, trying to make sure that we are, in fact, increasing. Those are the statistics that, and a group that meets, I think our next meeting is next week, as I recall, on a regular basis to not only look at the numbers, but also see how well we're doing and where we're not doing well. We are doing well. We're doing better because of a request to in increasing the number of administrators, minority administrators, but in terms of teachers, we continue to fail to attract minority teachers and keep them. It's not just attracting, but it's actually keeping them in the profession. That's one of the issues, and that issue is both related to minority, the minority status, but also just simply teachers. Mm-hmm. We're having problems keeping teachers because of a number of things that you and I don't want to go into right now. This attempts to say we already have people who are there ready to work. They just need the support. These two programs provide that support.
And I remember your bill, right, changing the language on that.
Can I make a comment regarding it?
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that up. I think that's extremely important. And one of the things I want you guys to really understand is that culturally relevant pedagogy and practice is just not for white educators. Right. It's for everybody. It's because we all have to have that type of lens and be able to relate. The teaching on purpose is a teaching practice, and it's based around three principles: having high expectations, building relationships, and then also providing culturally relevant materials within your classroom. So it's based around those three principles. So yes, we do need to increase the number of teachers of color into the classroom, but at the same time, that's not going to make the total difference because through my experience, we all need this type of training.
And Representative McLean.
Oh, I simply wanted to thank all of you for being here today, and I appreciated your presentations and also the teachers. And really, I support your goals and I support your sentiment. And I also support the professional standards that you set today for how we support, and the comment that you just made goes directly to that. I have been very fortunate to be able to teach speech and debate 42 years in the state, and we do a lot of the things that you describe as being good practices. But I had a young man who came as a as a 9-year-old here to this country as an undocumented student. And he just, as a 19-year-old going to PCC, gave a TED Talk yesterday on immigration and wanting the support, some of the same support issues for young people who are here in Oregon for a number of different reasons with different backgrounds and different experiences and different family issues and situations. And how do you support that student as they're trying to get to be the first generation of their family to go to college? And so those high expectations, those standards, I think, are very important. This sounds like a really interesting program, and I'm going to try to be at the next conference.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hello. Well, last comment.
Last comment. Aaron, I wanted to be an astronaut as well. In fact, I got that close. I was one of the top 100 journalists in space, and then we had an accident. So I didn't get a chance to go up, but I still want to go to space, and I still think you
not
can
me.
Go to...
No. I get queasy on my second floor landing.
So, again, thank you for being here. Thank you for the efforts you put into the conference, and thank you for what Eastern Oregon is doing. So, with that, we're going to end this informational hearing, and the Senate is going to take a recess and reconvene in hearing room B.
Okay.
We're going to come out of recess for the Senate Interim Committee on Education, and with that, I'm going to ask.
Education, I like that.
That's right.
That's my favorite subject.
I did well in recess as well. Senator Farrioli and Steve, do you want to both come up to the dais? We have on the phone Senator Hammond, and we're going to get an introduction about this particular informational hearing. With that, Senator Farrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity just to help introduce the discussion, and I also appreciate very much the committee's time and energy to look at the issue. Recently, the state
Who
of Nevada enacted. Oh, Senator Ted Farrioli, for the record, thank you for the reminder. Recently, the state of Nevada enacted Senate Bill 302, or an analogy, which allows Nevada parents to have children enrolled in a public school or charter school to choose the option that's best for their child's individualized education program. Nevada is the fifth state to offer an education savings account, and that's the most inclusive of all of the existing proposals for such a program. In Nevada, about 93% of students are reached by this opportunity. The only requirement for eligibility is that the student must have been enrolled in a public school for 100 consecutive days. The best tool we can give to Oregon parents and students to maximize their success in education is choice. And the education savings account offers that sort of choice so that the unique learning needs of each student and family can be met. The education savings account gives families the tool so that they can actually make the choices a reality. Today we will hear from Senator Hammond from Nevada, and have an opportunity to hear what a program like the Education Savings Account has meant to Nevada students, parents, families, and districts, and perhaps we can take those lessons and see which of them may be applicable for Oregon schools. I'm very grateful for the presence of Mr. Buckstein, who will give you a particular overview of some of the details of such a program.
Thank you. Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute, based in Portland. I'm actually not going to give details because I'll leave that to Senator Hammond. But as most of you know, Cascade Policy Institute has been promoting more choice in education in Oregon for almost 25 years now. And in 1999, we put together a model public charter school bill that helped result in Oregon entering the charter school world. In that year, Governor Kitzhaber actually at that time signed the bill into law. But since then, the world of educational choice has really taken some giant leaps forward. The older voucher and tax credit programs that you may be familiar with that have been enacted in some states can now, I think, really be likened to the rotary telephones of the choice world. The iPhones of the educational choice world our educational savings accounts. Several states, as Senator Ferrioli mentioned, have adopted small, more limited education savings account programs. There was a bill in the legislature here in 2014 that we helped work on that would have been a limited program. But Nevada, as the senator pointed out, has now passed a virtually universal educational savings account program that's scheduled to launch next year. Senator Hammond was a public school teacher. He was the chief sponsor of the bill in Nevada. He was a public school teacher for over 15 years, and he really has a passion. I've met him and talked to him. Really had a passion for helping every Nevada child learn to the best of their ability. He'd hoped that he could be here in person with you today, but his schedule didn't allow it. So just want to say in introduction that I think both Senator Hammond, I know Senator Ferrioli, myself, and hopefully others in this building, really would like to see Oregon move in the direction that Nevada is moving, to provide much more choice for all students and help them and their families to achieve the potential that, as we heard in the previous hearing, all kids have and should have. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Senator Hammond, this is Senator Roblin. I appreciate you taking your time today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate it. I'll tell you a little bit about the program, and then I think I'll just open myself up for any questions you have. I guess, first of all, I'll tell you that the reason I decided to go with an education savings account, and, I've always been a champion of school choice, is because, I really believe that every child is different. I have been a public school teacher for 16 years. I now find myself as an administrator in a charter school. I was on the board of a charter school, started a local charter school about 5 years ago. We now have five campuses. I stepped down from the board in order to take an administrative position in order to kind of get a feel for running a school, a school system, sort of, as an administrator instead of as a teacher. So my passion really is in education. And I'll tell you that some of the things, the trends that we've seen over the last 20 years, we really have come up with an idea of exactly how every student is taught and how they learn. You've seen, I think since the 80s, this movement towards adequate funding for education and also realizing that every child learns differently and therefore requires sometimes, in some cases, different amounts of money in order to achieve the same results. So when I look at that, and again, being a classroom teacher and being asked by administrators, being asked by the system to make sure I hit every single child in my class, regardless of where they're at, so I had to differentiate my instruction. I kept thinking to myself, there's got to be a better way. How, you can differentiate your instruction a lot, which we can. We've come up with tools to do that. But would it be more simple to allow a child to go to a school that fits their way of learning and fits their level, allows, customization in some cases? Does it always have to be a school? Could it be a different way of learning? Could it be a different, a different delivery system of education? So having considered these for many years, as soon as I saw what an ESA does, that's the direction I took. Now, I of course, did things a little differently with my bill, but what we have here is we have a system that allows money to follow a child. It follows the child and it follows the individual education system that they need. You know, some people have compared the ESA to an operating system, like a Apple phone, if you will. You have the operating system, the iOS, but then the thing that really makes the Apple phone or any other kind of phone service like that really desirable is the apps that go with it. You know, how you use your phone, because you customize your phone to your particular needs. And that's what we have here with the ESA. Now, currently there's not a lot of apps out there. There's not a lot of delivery of education, but that's what an ESA does. It gives all these people who have great ideas for delivering education a platform to deliver their ideas. And so that's why when somebody introduced that, that thought to my mind, I kind of grasped it, because that's kind of how the program works. You have an operating system, and then you have a lot of people coming in saying, this is how you can deliver education to this particular child or that particular child. It does require that there's going to be some involvement with the parents, and that's the part that we're really pushing here now. We're getting people out on the pavement. We're hitting the roads and making sure we talk to a lot of different groups about what's available to them. I've started a nonprofit here with the whole intention of making sure we get the education component out there to parents, to let them know what we have. But that's what we have within an education savings account. Some of the things that make it work, I'll tell you some of the particulars of the bill. First of all, we decided to ask the Treasurer's Department to set up our program. We wanted to go with somebody who deals with money all the time. So we were setting it up there. Some people have set it up with the, you know, it depends on taxation. It just depends on where you would like to put it. I avoided the Department of Education because they already have a lot on their plate, and I don't want this. This is not necessarily something that they need to be involved in, although we do have a lot of cooperation between the two agencies. One of the features that we came up with is, you know, people are always worried about fraud, so we decided that when somebody signs up for an education savings account, the institution that is set up, we have a financial institution where the money will be delivered, then the parents will decide where it will be spent, but the financial institution will receive quarterly installments. It won't be one lump sum. It'll be quarterly installments. There will be receipts that will be necessary to hold on to, invoices that will be necessary to hold on to, and then a lot of those invoices will be sent to the Treasurer's Department. Random audits will be conducted. The education that's delivered, let's say that somebody wants to use a curriculum at home, all the curriculum, schools, tutors, they all have to be pre-approved by the Treasurer's Office. There'll be a list of education delivery systems that'll be available to the parent so that they, you know, we know what kind of system we have, we know who's delivering the education. And then basically the parent will decide. What I love about it is, again, it's customizable. So, for example, if you have one of the schools here, now there's going to be some schools where it's going to cost more than the education savings account allows a parent to have. We're giving around $5,100 to every single parent who signs up for this. The $5,100 can go to a variety of things. If you go to a school where the tuition is $3,900, you have money left over, you can get a tutor if the child still needs help with acquisition of English language or if they need math. You could, instead of going to a school, you could then get tutoring, or you could go to the YMCA and take a swim class that could qualify for your PE. It's just so customizable. This is the answer to the future. We're going to have money follow the kids, and then the kids will put together their education plan based on all these entities that deliver education that are pre-approved by the state. Somebody once asked me, how does this work if, you know, you've got a child who, they want to concentrate in math? Well, I've seen this where, you know, we could hire a math tutor or a professor at the university. They get together with three or four friends. They go over to a business or a home or something like that. The education has been delivered for an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever is decided by the two parties. Then the student, it goes to something else during that day. That's how customizable it is. That's what I love about the system. It really allows the students to decide what they like and how they like it delivered. I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to know about the program, although I should mention that one of the features I like about it is it also, the savings account is if you don't use all the money 1 year, it rolls over to the next year. So it also teaches financial responsibility and puts the onus on the user. And it rolls over. One of the features that I did not get through this session, but we'll work on again, is it rolls over into your graduating year of high school, and that's about it. One of the things I wanted it to do is roll over to that first or maybe even second year of higher ed to help pay for the cost of tuition in that first year of higher ed, but it didn't get through this time.
So I guess what I would like to have is a little bit more background on with regard to the $5,100. Does that come out of this basic school fund that is then transferred to the savings account if the people sign up for it? And does that remove them from using the regular K-12 school system as well because they've taken the money out of it? And is that the amount that generally is spent per student in Nevada?
Okay. Great question. The money, the $5,100 comes out. Actually, it's the distributed school account. Monies are delivered to the state. The state, every year when we get together in Carson City, we decide on the per pupil funding through the distributed school account. The distributed school account will be about $5,700, just a little north of that this time. We're allowing students to take 90% of that, which is around $5,100. 3% of which will be taking, which the treasurer can take in order to administer the program. And so that's not the whole amount that the student would get. There will be students who, in Clark County, for example, which is our largest county where Las Vegas is located, students will be able to withdraw $5,100, which is the state portion of the per pupil expenditures every year. But there's also included in there local amounts that that says $5,100 will not take out. So the local money will still go into the school, as well as some federal monies that will be attached to Title I schools, for example. The kids will not have access to that. So the $5,100 basically comes from the state's portion of making sure that there's a minimum level of per pupil funding for the students. So that's what goes into that $5,100. In some cases, where a student can prove a learning disability or a certain poverty level, they will have access to the entire DSA, which is about $5,700.
And so,
once they do take that, then no, they won't have access to any of the public schools. They would have to use another mode of education.
And once they use that, you know, we have this mandatory education things at our state, and I think you have one maybe to ninth grade as well. Do they have to prove to someone that they're in an education program? Do they have to have a plan that this is how it's going to be spent, that they can be followed to make sure the child is getting an education?
Every year they must take a norm referenced exam. Okay. In order to show that they have improved year to year, that they have they've been educated. So they, you know, the plan is to make sure that they're being tested, and they can choose the test of their choice as long as it's a norm reference exam. But they have to prove that they are still delivering an education, and then, you know, there will be that'll allow us to kind of evaluate whether or not that student is improving or not, and then we can take corrective action if need be.
And so those federal funds and the local funds that are going into the school that are not part of this, they're, after we figure out how many leave the system, that's allocated by the number of students that are left, so that schools will get a little bit more money of some of that form than they would have gotten per kid, because there won't be as many kids? Is that?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And not only that, here in Las Vegas, in the southern part of our state, we're still, in the northern part as well, we're still experiencing a surge of students. And so we still have a lack of facilities, if you will. We're still trying to build schools. So this will actually help with the overcrowding situation that we have as well.
Were there any estimates done when you were doing this process to anticipate how many people might choose to sign up for it?
We did kind of some research. We weren't sure the particular question of how many would sign up for it. No, we did not. One of the concerns, of course, was that we'd have too many people right away, and we might be putting a hole in our budget. When I first proposed the idea, the Legislative Council Bureau, who helps us write our legislation, they had drafted the legislation to include everybody in the state. Regardless of whether or not you were already in private school or already being homeschooled, that would have put if we had done it that way and kept it that way, that would have put a hole in our budget to the tune of around $250 million, just north of $250 million. So we put a provision in the bill that said that if you are currently in a private school or currently being homeschooled, and because we don't budget for those individuals, they've been withdrawn from the system, that if you wanted to have access to DSA, you would have to return to public school for a term of 100 days
and then you could get out and then access an ESA account. The reason we did that is obvious, but one of the things I thought would happen is if, you know, if you're in a school that you like, you love, you can budget for it, then, you know, most likely you're not going to take your student out and put them back into a school that they're not familiar with, they're not used to, they don't want to be there. They could probably stay there, and then we could slowly sort of matriculate all the students in over time. And so over the summer, there was a big panic that, you know, a lot of people were just going to take their kids out, put them in public schools, increase the number of public schools, and then withdraw them, and then, of course, create that hole. But that really didn't come to fruition. I think that the rationale was proven, and it was a pretty good logic that, you know, most parents would stay where their kids were comfortable because they didn't want to jeopardize their education. And, you know, we'll slowly work them in. There are parents who are currently, you know, being educated in a private school that, quite frankly, are just barely making it. You know, parents are working two jobs, maybe three jobs, maybe took out a loan, and so they're not wealthy parents, but they want to keep their kids in the ESA, or I'm sorry, they want to keep their kid in a private school. I think for those students, we might be able to go back in and start to allow them access to a portion of the distributed school account or an ESA, maybe not 90% of the DSA, but maybe 10-15% to help them because they're just barely making it. But that's later down the road. What we did, though, in regulation is we did stipulate that if you are, and this is part of the, I know you have the bill in front of you somewhere, I think it was in Section 7, we said that if you weren't mandated to be in school, you know, there's a part in there about being mandated. Well, in the state of Nevada, the mandate is 7 years of age or older. So if you're 7 years of age or older, you had to return to public school for 100 days. But if you're younger than that, you didn't. And so we put in regulation that if you are entering your kindergarten year and you're under that age category at 7, then you would have access to an ESA immediately. That means that the state of Nevada is on track to be 100% school choice eligible in 13 years or less.
And my last question, and I'll open it up to the rest of the committee, has to do with once you are in the program, then there's no requirement to go back to any school for 100 days. So the following year, say you enter in as a first grader, you get to keep doing it each year and renew. If you decide to go back to a school, that's your choice, right?
That's correct. That is correct. One of the things that we have started doing here in the state of Nevada, we used to do a yearly drop count to find out where students were and then allocate monies accordingly. We are switching to a sort of a quarterly drop count. And so that really, you know, plays in with the ESA because, like I said, we're only delivering the money quarterly. So if a student says, it's just not working for me and decide to go back to public school, the public school is not out that not out of those funds. The money will follow the students back into either public school or back to home school, or not home school, but back to private school or charter school or whatever.
And I guess I had one more because it popped up. You have $5,100. You said you could do that. Actually, your parents could hire tutors in a particular areas. You just have to make sure that you take the test annually and show improvement. Could you hire your husband to be the tutor?
No.
Okay.
No, we put a provision in there that would not allow that. First of all, the tutor does have to be an accredited tutor. That the tutor will be on that list. Okay. And you are not eligible to hire your family members.
Perfect. Thank you. Any questions from the rest of the committee about this? Sorry that I took all the questions, but I have a lot of questions.
You took mine. How long have you been in the place?
How long? It hasn't started yet, right?
It has not. It will start in January, and the first disbursement of monies will occur in February.
Right.
And we have two pieces of litigation that have popped up, and so those two will have to be taken care of. But the plan is to start in January. There has been nothing that has been indicated to me or anybody else that this will be stopped until the litigation is over. We're going to proceed forward and wait for a court decision on the two cases later on.
One more little question.
Are parochial schools eligible?
No.
They
are.
They're
yeah.
eligible. This is what makes it interesting because one of the lawsuits says that no money whatsoever in character or whatever can be spent on faith-based schools.
that the state can't spend on faith-based schools. But the reality is we're not, you know, the state's not spending it at faith-based schools. They're not spending it at a Catholic school. We're giving it to parents, and the parents are deciding where to go. So there's no predestined money going to any one particular school. And if the school doesn't pass muster, then the, you know, the students probably won't go there. And so it's really about the perfect fit for the kid, and it's about making sure that the school is providing a really high level of education. I know that some of the, you know, private schools here in our state have said, this has been great. I can't believe this is wonderful. You saved us. Well, I would tell them, I know my purpose for this was never to save private schools. My purpose was always to deliver an education system or education, an individualized education to a student. That you guys are going to have to provide really great education before somebody chooses. So that's what it's first about. But going back to that faith-based, it's no different from when we give somebody Medicaid dollars and we say, go where you want. We don't decide whether or not they should go to a faith-based hospital or not. It really is up to the parents at that point.
Okay. Any other questions? I personally, and I think I speak for the whole committee, thank you for taking your time today and for answering the questions, because you read the bill, you look at it, and you have an idea what it's doing, but it really helps to talk to the person whose idea it was to flesh out kind of how that all works. So I really thank you very much. Is there anything last that our Steve or...
Just one additional thing that I think is an important benefit of ESAs for the whole state, Nevada in this case would be for Oregon. Today, our funding mechanisms for education are basically on the producer side. If the legislature gives here, it's more than $5,700, say $6,100 or $6,500 to the public school system per child, there's no incentive for them to spend a dollar less than that. It's all spent. If you were to allocate a voucher system where you gave, say, $5,100 to kids, the schools would know that, and they would never charge a penny less than $5,100. But with an education savings account, if you give $5,100 to a child, the schools know that, but they also know that anything saved can be rolled over into future or used for tutors or other educational opportunities. So it creates a market, and it helps hold down the cost. If there are two comparable schools that a family is looking at, one charges $5,100, one charges $4,500, the family gets to save the difference. So it really puts a market discipline in education that has never been there before.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Farrell.
Mr. Chair, the experience of the committee members individually, I will hazard a guess, is very much similar to my own. Yeah, some places I will talk to parents and they will be wildly enthusiastic about the model that they're through which they're being delivered education for their kids. It could be a public school, could be a home school, could be a charter school. Other places we've got a very different experience. 50 to 75% dropout rates in some of the schools in my district, particularly on the reservation or in places where there's serious economic issues that are not being dealt with in the community. And those parents may be very dissatisfied with the educational model that's as it's being offered. But the one thing I'm absolutely certain of, any model, regardless of the configuration, that creates greater involvement by parents in making the choices that they want to make for their families increases all of the positive outcomes. It just follows. If the parents are engaged in a private school situation where they're paying additional tuition, but they also have to volunteer at the school, you see a lot higher satisfaction with the parents and a lot better outcomes for the students. If there's a very active program for parental involvement in the public schools, you get the same result. So, you know, any model, in my estimation, that empowers the parents and involves them in making educational choices, you get better outcomes. I would just suggest to you that we don't have enough of that sort of model offered in the public education system. And any opportunity that we have to introduce different models that could feature those sort of opportunities I think that changes the whole dialogue about education and how we deliver it. So I'm very happy to see anybody coming up with different models that feature empowerment and parental involvement. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. One more question from
Senator Hammond, it isn't clear to me, the $5,100, is that a, to be very basic, is that a check that's written to the parent, or is that a draw account that the chosen vendor bills against?
I think I heard the question. It is not a check that's written directly to the parent. It's a money that is placed into the account at the financial institution. Then the parent must pay the entities that will be delivering the education, and then those invoices will be delivered to the treasurer. So the parents are not going to get one lump sum of money, thinking that they're going to go spend it on whatever. It has to be an education.
Quarterly, yeah, through the treasurer's office.
Something that's there, and I appreciate that question because that comes up a lot. We want to make sure that the parents are educating their kids. That's first and foremost. And so we're putting these little steps in place, procedures in place to make sure that the money is going there. And of course, like I said, we're gonna make sure that the audits are random and that they make sure that they go in and look at where the parents are spending the money. I mean, after a while, it becomes routine. You'll start to see the same invoices, and you'll know that entity is delivering education. But when an anomaly comes up, the auditors will be quick to be on that. But I appreciate that question.
Okay. Again, thank you from our committee and myself in particular for taking the time today to be with us. And we're going
to. Thank you. I thank you very much, Senator. I appreciated the comments at the end. This really is all about empowering the student and the parents. I found that as I've done this, I've heard from so many parents. I've had one family of four. They said, look, we want to make sure we found the right school or the right delivery system for our children. They had four children. The oldest was in a public school because that was the place that they really wanted to be. They found the model to be the perfect solution for their needs. The next son went to a private school. The next in the middle school. And then the next one was being taught at home, homeschooled, because they wanted that was the best thing for that child. And then the last, the elementary school age child was in a public school. In a great setting for them. So this really is about empowering parents to make that right choice, the right fit for their kid, and to be on top of their education. And then secondarily, it's about children buying into where they're going to school. It really does cut down, and I don't know if I can make this claim, but I'm going to say that when my experience, when a child chooses where they're going to school, they love it, they own it, they feel that ownership, and they go more often, and that's when you're having more results, better results in education.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for the time. I really would have loved to have been there. It's a great time of the year to be up in Oregon, and I apologize I couldn't be there in person, but I appreciate you allowing me this honor of calling in.
Okay. It worked well. And with that, we're going to close our public hearing and informational hearing. And we will open one on a SAT update, and we'll invite Terry Whitney, Matthew Lisk, and Matt, did you want to come up or just? Okay, come on up. Today is our assessment day, so we are trying to make sure we have a better understanding of things and how the College Board is doing.
Chairman Roblin, Vice Chairman Knope, members of the committee, I'm Terry Whitney, Government Relations Director, West Region for the College Board. We appreciate your invitation to come and present today. Alongside me is Matt Lisk, who is our Executive Director of College and Career Programs. And for those of you that may not be familiar with the College Board, we have existed since 1900. We are a mission-driven organization made up of a membership of colleges and universities around the country. Close to about 7,000 institutions are members of the College Board at this point. And our mission is to connect students with college and career success and opportunity. So we very much appreciate being able to have a conversation with you today in terms of some new programs that we will be rolling out in the near future, and I'll turn it over to Matt.
And before that, I'll make one editorial comment. They have an advisory board made up of students from around the country at the College Board.
Correct.
And our high school had the privilege of having three of those members over different years. They have four-year terms. And it was very good for our school because the kids would come back and talk about the new things that they were talking about, but outstanding opportunity for students. So if there are students and people listening and hearing this, there are ways to get involved in understanding all of the new things that are happening at the College Board as a participant. So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's correct. Chairman, committee members, thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Matt Lisk, and I will apologize in advance for my voice. I've been spending a lot of time on airplanes lately, so it's been hard to keep a good speaking voice, but I'll do my best to get you the information that I'd love to share today. I really appreciated the previous conversation and being able to hear that. I heard the words empowering students, empowering parents, opportunities. That's really what the College Board and more specifically the SAT program has been focused on over the past 18 months to 2 years in the redesign of our suite of assessments. Our president, David Coleman, at our national forum last week declared assessments without opportunity are dead, which has really been sort of the driving force behind the redesign of our assessments, that if a student is going to take a test, there needs to be an opportunity that's tied to it. The feedback needs to be meaningful. It needs to be able to empower students and parents to make better decisions and to figure what course of action to take based on those assessment results. So with that, we have the College Board Readiness and Success System, where you see focused assessments are just one part of this puzzle, that the other pieces that we think are critical to making this path for students easier to navigate include a personalized practice platform, which I'll talk about in a second, which is our innovative partnership with the Khan Academy to be able to deliver a platform for students to practice and get ready for these assessments. The opportunity piece, the college opportunity piece, it's not just important to have a credential. You need assistance and information and ways to get there and support. That's vital to a student's success as they move through this suite of assessments. And then finally, career opportunities, giving them better information earlier in the process so that they can tie back career choices to skills that they may need, college majors they may be interested in, and what their strengths and weaknesses are and how to address them. We feel like our exclusive partnerships are delivering these unprecedented benefits to students, educators, as well as states and districts. My role at the College Board is to be in charge of all of our statewide implementations, and I'll talk about that towards the end of our conversation, as there are five states who are using the SAT as their 11th grade federal accountability exam in spring of 2016. So I want to give you some information about that. Focused assessments, this is really just the redesign of the assessment suite itself. The few things that matter most, work that students are already doing in the classroom. This has been a primary source of pushback on the SAT, that the SAT was something that students needed to prepare for outside of the classroom, that there were some tips and tricks and special sauce and all these things that contributed to success on the SAT that were things that were outside of the work they were doing in the classroom. We strive to make these assessments clear and open. The test specifications have been available publicly for almost 2 years now. We are removing the guessing penalty, so we're moving to a rights-only scoring formula so that there's no need for a student to think about test strategies, that it's really just measuring what they're learning in their classroom. And then finally, useful benchmarks and consistent feedback, getting better information into the students' and parents' hands so that they understand where they really are in the process and what they need to improve on. Some of the key changes that are being made to the SAT, these are actually really
consistent with a lot of the changes that we've seen in standards that are happening across the country. So when we talk about relevant words in context, it's not understanding obscure words, or if you've heard the term SAT words, flashcards with words that are super tricky that nobody ever uses in real life, that they'll never have an application outside of taking the test, those have been removed. Students will be able to understand the definition of that word based on the context in which it's used. Command of evidence, a key component to a lot of the standards that have been changed throughout the country. An essay analyzing a source. So students will be asked to read a source document and analyze the author's argument as opposed to a generic prompt which asks for their opinions on certain topics. Focused math. And not just focused math, but also math proficiency with and without a calculator, which is a key component to success in post-secondary endeavors. And problems grounded in real-world context, analysis in science and social studies, founding documents in the great global conversations. Each form of the SAT moving forward will have one of these reading as a reading passage on all of our ongoing forms. So the Declaration of Independence, Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, are great examples of what those would be like. So students don't need historical context. They need to be able to read and understand the passage and be able to answer questions on those. And then finally, no penalty for wrong answers. Now, the reasons we're making these changes is because research has shown that there are certain things that students need to succeed at in order to be successful in post-secondary endeavors. And that same set of research is a lot of the same research that has driven these changes in standards. So at the end of the day, what ultimately happens is that the SAT is very strongly aligned to many states' standards, including Oregon's. And as part of the documents provided for the record, we did provide an alignment study that we've conducted that aligns our SAT suite of assessments to the Oregon state standards. And you'll find the alignment to be strong to very strong across reading, writing, and math. So we do realize that college readiness is not a point in time, that we need to give better information to students throughout the process. We've got three assessments that intend to do that. Our PSAT 8-9, which is for 8th and 9th grade students, previously known as ReadyStep. This is sort of your readiness baseline. Where do I stand? What do I need to work on? PSAT and MSQT is our 10th grade and 11th grade test. This, again, intended to check in and focus on the skills that you really need to improve on. And then that SAT, that final assessment system to connect to college, and that's where we talk about delivering opportunity in those SAT results. Better information coming back from the score, so from the test, is a prime component to the redesign. So we used to just give numbers, and what we're intending to do here is really drill down in those key areas. So providing section scores and test scores and then sub-scores to provide more information to students, to parents, to educators, so that they've got a better understanding of, you know, when we talk about does a student have command of evidence? Do they have the ability to do that, to show that proficiency, that we give them a measure that shows if they're on target or if they're behind, and if they're behind, how far they're behind. All of this information will get loaded into the focus practice, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. The assessment system, the redesigned system, will be placed on a common vertical scale. What that will allow us to do is to measure year-over-year growth in a more effective way. So in theory, if a student sits for the PSAT 8-9 and gets a 500 on the math section, that would be equivalent to if they actually sat for the SAT on that same day and took the SAT, they would also get a 500 on that section. So the fact that it's on a common backbone, a common vertical scale, the only difference in the tests is the grade appropriate content, which is reflected in the score scales. So you'll see that on the SAT, there's a score scale that trends up to an 800, whereas on the PSAT 89, it goes down into a 120. That allows us to give a little bit more granular information at the top and the bottom end of those scales based on that grade appropriate content. This PowerPoint has more information in it than you could possibly cover in 15 minutes here today, but I wanted to make sure that you had that. So when I talk about grade level appropriate content, you can see the expectations across the three assessments. So if there's a slide in there about the evidence-based reading and writing as well as the math and what the expectations would be for each of those grade levels. So for your review and certainly follow up if there's ever a need for that. When we talk about better information into educators' hands, these are the kinds of reports that we're delivering. Online portals we've moved to as opposed to paper reports so that educators, students, and parents can actually drill down, click, get real-time dynamic information. You'll see there's benchmark information on here, so students will understand if they are meeting or exceeding the current benchmark, which would be indicated by green. If they're approaching the benchmark within a year's worth of growth, that would indicate as a yellow. And then, of course, if you're further than a year behind in terms of where you need to be in that skill, it would show up as a red. These are just some sample reports. The one thing I will show you on this slide is that in the educator portal, anywhere where we have a subscore, we're tying those back to your state standards. So your teachers, your curriculum and instruction folks, when they get reports back from their students who have taken the SAT, they can click through on those subscores and see which state standards those tie back to. So it's better information to make meaningful changes in curriculum and instruction. And again, this, you know, again, there's several examples of what these reports look like in here. This would be when we have a disclosed form. Teachers can actually drill down and take a look at the question item, the number of students who answered it correctly, incorrectly, their incorrect choices, the item itself, the answer explanation for that. So we're trying to put more information into teachers' hands, into counselors' hands, into parents' hands. What's been a challenge for us is all that information has been available. It hasn't been in a very user-friendly format. So we're trying to put it all together in this online portal for easy delivery. Student reports, again, giving them more insight than just a top-level number. The number is useful and meaningful, but having the information behind that is what's really going to drive student success. Personally, it's not just enough to give them better information and have a stronger assessment, but we have to help them get ready for it. We've created a partnership with the Khan Academy to deliver SAT practice to students around the globe at absolutely no charge. If you're familiar with the Khan Academy, their innovative way of delivering instruction to students is something that we were looking to leverage. So that we could better prepare students. And not just, and this goes back to my earlier comment, is that this is not meant to be something that's standalone from the classroom. This is meant to supplement the things that are going on in the classroom. So they're not learning different skills or different things outside of their classroom by taking this practice, but that they are reinforcing the concepts, the skills. They're being shown things in a different way that maybe they didn't currently understand in the classroom. And it's personalized. So a student has the ability to go into the Khan Academy platform to take a series of diagnostic questions, and the platform will assess where they stand in terms of their readiness. And it will develop a personalized learning plan for them that will serve up content based on their current weak areas that they need to focus on. Once they take one of our assessments, whether it's the PSAT or the SAT, they can opt to send that score information over to the Khan Academy platform and have that personalized learning plan updated based on the actual assessment results. So they have several opportunities to show whether they're making progress and have that information continuously updated. And again, the platform will serve up the content where students need to focus the most. If that's not enough to encourage students to actually take practice seriously, We've developed a smartphone app that allows the students to actually print out the bubble sheets, take a practice test at their kitchen table or in a computer lab, wherever they want, and take a picture of that practice test. And that practice test would get uploaded into the platform and create an update to their learning plan. So there's several different ways in which the student can interact based on their access to technology. We've partnered with the Boys and Girls Club to make this available in their clubs nationwide. So if a student doesn't have access to the Khan Academy platform at their home or at their school, they can go to a Boys and Girls Club where we have trained their staff to be able to help students navigate that platform. So it's really about bringing practice and focused practice and to the students and to the community. It's not enough to just have the assessment, to have the practice tools, but we need to make sure that that the test is opening doors for students. So we've worked with our scholarship partners to increase the amount of funds that are available for students who are participating in PSAT and SAT. Over $180 million was just added this year. AP Potential continues to identify students to take advantages of the opportunities they've earned, to find students who could succeed in AP courses and get them into those courses by providing that information back to schools, to districts, to ensure that they've got the proper programming in place. So if we find that several students are qualified and would succeed in a certain AP course, that information is provided to that school to determine whether they can offer that course or not. And again, also identifying individual students who are capable of the higher level work of an AP class. Exam and college admission fee waivers. This has really been a focus area for us. So students who are financially eligible, typically students who are on free and reduced price lunch, get to take the SAT two times at no cost. They get to send their scores to up to 8 institutions at no cost. They also get up to 4 college application fee waivers. And what we've tried to do is take some of the stigma out of that process because we know that students are frustrated and don't want to keep going back to counselors saying, I need help, I need financial assistance. So we've taken the initiative to, if a student gets a fee waiver and takes the SAT, they automatically get college application fee waivers deposited into their account. They can submit those to have the application fee waived automatically without ever having to go back to their counselor and asking for additional assistance. And then finally, expansion of our SAT school day. The SAT, if you remember when I took it and several other people probably in this room had taken it, it was on a Saturday. Now we've moved that into the weekday. So if a school is willing to forego that day of instruction, they have the ability to offer the SAT to all of their students. There are 5 states where they're doing this statewide, as well as several of the largest districts in the country that are also taking advantage of this program. And then finally, when we talk about career opportunity, not necessarily a hardcore work skills assessment, but more career exploration and planning information that helps students think about what their future may be, things that interest them, hearing from people of similar backgrounds. We've partnered with Road Trip Nation, and if you haven't seen their PBS programming, I would highly encourage you to do that. They put 4 first-generation students in a green RV and drive them around the country to interview people who are successful in a wide variety of industries and a wide variety of backgrounds. And it could be Howard Schultz. It could be, I'm trying to remember some of the more recent ones, but it's an extensive library of video content that students will have access to that will help them match their interests so that they can see video content. It can help them think about the skills that they need to develop and then have honest conversations with their counselors about, am I in the right courses based on my interests? And how do I get there? And, you know, based on my assessment results, am I pursuing the things that would be of interest to me as well as things that I might actually succeed at? Finally, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the work that I do on a day-to-day basis. There will be five states who are using the SAT, as I mentioned earlier, as their high school assessment for federal accountability this spring. Michigan, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Maine, and Delaware. Each one of them has a slightly different story to it. So Michigan uses a college entrance exam as part of a three-day assessment. Day one is the college entrance exam. Day two is a work skills assessment. Day three is a homegrown science social studies component. Up until this year, the Michigan Department of Education was using ACT as the college entrance component. The work went out to bid, and the SAT was chosen as the replacement college entrance exam for that. Through this year, because of ACT's alignment to Michigan standards, they had to do an additional 8 hours of testing in ELA and math on the third day as an augmentation. By using the SAT and moving to that, they were able to eliminate that third day of augmentation because of the strong alignment of the SAT to the Michigan state standards. So it saved them 8 hours of instructional time by adopting the redesigned SAT. They'll be using Smarter Balance in 3-8, and we have committed to do a crosswalk back to that 3-8 assessment system so that they have a growth model year over year that's meaningful and reliable. Connecticut, New Hampshire, using Smarter Balanced in 3-8. We will again do that crosswalk back to them. Maine was using the SAT for accountability for several years, moved to Smarter Balanced, and now is moving back to the SAT after a year. They put out an RFP that we responded to in combination with Measured Progress. So it's an innovative partnership that we have created with Measured Progress, where Measured Progress will be using SAT's test specifications and item development procedures to develop the items for the 3-8 assessment. So, and it will be a Measured Progress assessment product, but it will be tied very closely to the work that we've done in redesigning the SAT. And then finally, Delaware hasn't been totally publicly announced yet, but they are moving to the SAT as their 11th grade assessment as well. So states that have moved have cited the need to eliminate duplicative testing, reducing overtesting, mitigating student stress, using an assessment that has a meaning to that student. And that actually has the opportunity to provide scholarship dollars, that has the opportunity for students to be found by institutions for recruiting purposes. So that's really been some of the reasons that they've gone out and said, we're going to make this change. We have committed to providing all the assistance in making that happen. So the U.S. Department of Ed has requirements around the high-quality assessment work plan and what that needs to look like and all the technical documents that need to support that. The College Board provides all of that support to those states in order to be able to meet those requirements. And then finally, I talked about this earlier, but you do have the alignment report that shows that the alignment of the SAT to the Oregon state standards is strong to very strong. You know, if I had to highlight one area that where we don't address the Oregon state standards is we will not be measuring speaking and listening skills as part of the SAT, at least in the near future. So, you know, that would be one obvious area where we would say there's not an alignment. But in ELA and math, as you review that document, you'll find that strong to very strong. So it still provides opportunities for the students in Oregon and ties directly back to the work that they're doing in the classroom. With that, I will pause here. Thanks so much for your time, and I'd be glad to take any questions that you have.
Yeah, a couple short questions because we've got one more presentation. So, sure. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt or Terry, there's been a lot of pushback from teachers and parents and students on Smarter Balance. So it sounds like the SAT aligns in the high school years but doesn't have a test for 3-8. So is there a plan to do that at some point, and are there other tests that are available if one doesn't want to go to continue to use Smarter Balance, as apparently Maine and others have chosen not to do?
Yeah, so we don't have the intention ourselves to develop a 3-8 assessment, but we have explored several partnerships with Measure Progress is a great example where they're working with us to develop those 3-8 assessments using our specs and our standards. We also do have that ability to do that crosswalk backwards too. So if a state is using Smarter Balance in 3-8, that growth model would be consistent. So when a student gets a Smarter Balance score in 8th grade, they can translate that into what their performance might be on the SAT suite of assessments from 8th through 12th grade.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you both. And as needed, we may have you come back.
Absolutely. Be glad to do it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yep. So we're going to close our informational hearing on the SAT and the College Board, and we're going to open an informational hearing on teacher feedback, first-year Smarter Balance assessment. So come on up. And bring anybody you want with you.
Oh, sure. You want to control that?
Thanks for being here, Hannah, and I'll let you do the introductions.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Rublin and members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, my name is Hannah Vandering. I'm an elementary physical education teacher, and I proudly represent 43,000 educators across the state as the president of the Oregon Education Association. And with me, I have...
Good morning. Colleen Milam. I'm the director of the Center for Great Public Schools at the Oregon Education Association, and the center really focuses on supporting teachers in their practice.
Great. So I want to first take the opportunity to thank you for your support in passing House Bill 2680 last year to allow us to have some time to explore the first administration of the Smarter Balanced Assessment and also reinforce the commitment to working together to create a balanced system of assessment for Oregon students. We're proud of the work that we've done over the last 18 months, and we're even more proud of the collaborative nature in which that work has happened with our Chief Education Officer, the Department of Education, and the Governor's Office. It's one of a kind. There's not another state where educators have truly led the way for the first proposal that's been moved forward to truly address the issue of assessment in Oregon. In my testimony today, I'd like to share a brief history of that work, and then I'd like to share information and focus on the survey that we conducted with members across the state to get their feedback on how the administration of Smarter Balance impacted students in the 2014-15 school year. I also want to look forward to our work as we explore building that system of assessment and the opportunity that we have right now at this moment in time as the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act moves, that there are states who are going to have the flexibility to truly build something that's great for students. And we have that opportunity to be one of those states, and we want to work together to make that happen. So our work began with an incredible group of educators from all across the state, and they worked to create a draft of a new path forward for Oregon, a system of assessment to empower meaningful student learning. This framework included 12 recommendations that would create this balanced system of assessment, and we took that first draft out into 19 forums across the state, and we asked for feedback from parents, from students, from educators, community leaders, to get their feedback on the first proposal and the recommendations that we had. We then took all of that feedback that we collected, there were over 500 participants, and we created a document that we entitled Voices from the Field. Voices from the Field showed us and shows everyone who attended and those who weren't able to attend the 8 themes that resulted from those conversations around the proposal and the recommendations. Those 8 themes were equity, assessment literacy, accountability, birth pre-kindergarten and post-secondary, whole child, smarter balanced assessment, technology, and implementation were all brought forward as the themes that really drove the input that we received. We took that input through the Voices from the Field, and we created a document that shows the input. So if you attended, you could see your input, and it also shows from that input that we received, the changes that we would make in the recommendation and the proposal. And that's online. Everyone has access to that. And we hope Oregonians will take a look and see what we heard around the proposal. Educators' input has been vital in the movement of the new path forward. It's also been very important to listen to students and parents and build something where Oregon students will have that quality system of assessment that they need. So after the administration of the 2014-15 Smarter Balanced, we conducted an informal survey of our members to get their feedback, again, on how that implementation impacted their students and education across Oregon. The purpose of the survey was to gain their perspective on the administration, and we received nearly 1,300 survey responses from educators across the state. These survey results, we believe, are an important piece of information that will help us as we move forward with the work of House Bill 2680 and our work to create that balanced system moving forward. We're thankful for the honest feedback, and there are over 160 pages of feedback that you'll see if you take a look at the document, and that feedback really did focus on the heart and soul of education, which is the students that we work with every day. Some of the results from the survey that we want to share and highlight with you. There were 95% of educators who responded to the survey reported that the preparation and administration of the Smarter Balanced Assessment significantly disrupted the student learning process. We heard from teachers almost unanimously that the administration had a very disruptive impact on school activities. So whether it was technology and the use of technology for learning, or use of the school library for teaching and learning, or access to other related subjects that weren't able to work directly with students during this time, like history, art, social studies, classroom reading instruction, and intervention services that students so desperately need. 94.8% of the respondents characterized the administration is very disruptive on the school day. The amount of time that was spent was seen as a real deterrent for our students to have the learning that they needed in order to make it through the school year with ready for college and career and ready to move forward. 95.9% of the respondents characterized the Smarter Balance as very disruptive on other programs and facilities, as I shared. The comments were really touching, and want to share just a few of those comments with you. Due to the test, my students lost a week and a half of instruction time in U.S. history. We lost a whole unit on World War II. I think this is an unacceptable loss for students. Another, the worst thing about this experience was the wasted instructional time. My students were scheduled to take it immediately following spring break. Then after the test, we had 2 days of school, and then the kids were off for 3 days for parent conferences. By the time we were able to resume regular instruction, they had not had reading instruction for almost a month. Students lost hours of instructional time. The lack of immediate feedback does nothing to help inform current instruction for students or their teachers. I encourage you to take a look at the comments from the survey and see how educators felt. It wasn't about bashing the Smarter Balanced Assessment. It was about the impact that it had on their students and how it breaks their heart to not have the ability to provide the instruction that they believe is necessary for their students. The expenditure of classroom time and test preparation and administration is a heavy price to pay, particularly in Oregon. Over the course of a K-12 experience for our students here in Oregon, our students receive about 1 year less of instructional time than the national average. And that's due to the cut days that we've had because of the disinvestment. So how do we move forward? How do we ensure that our students have a system of assessment that truly measures success? One that inspires curiosity and the love of learning, that informs instruction, that provides parents a truly meaningful understanding of where their child is in relation to the standards that we're responsible for? And how do we ensure it helps all of us, including policymakers like you, find the right paths to schools that work for every Oregon student? Many educators who participated in the survey appreciated the rigor of the test and even the methods. Most of the negative reaction was associated with how the assessment was administered and concern over how the results will be used. These sentiments are not uncommon among educators, which is why OEA is so committed to working together with the Governor's Office, the Chief Education Office, and the Oregon Department of Education to design a new system which better measures and enhances student learning. Good assessments should be used to guide instruction and help teachers understand where their students are excelling and where they need more work. They should provide parents meaningful information that allows them to support their child's learning. And most importantly, good assessments inspire students and promote learning. This is what we all want for our Oregon students. The following recommendations are a selection from our document, A New Path for Oregon, a system of assessment to empower student learning. Which has been provided previously to this committee and is online as well. First, implement the Student Assessment Bill of Rights in classroom practice. And we're working together with coalition partners to ensure we're implementing our Student Bill of Assessments that we're extremely proud of. We need to audit the number of assessments that are administered in schools and districts, including how much classroom time is devoted to them. Examine all assessments for cultural, linguistic, and developmental appropriateness to accommodate the learning style of all students. Equity has been a huge issue around the way we've been using assessments in our schools, and we need to address that. Research the possibility of administering fewer assessments while ensuring the availability of accurate, yearly disaggregatable data for all student groups. Psychometricians can help us find that way. There is a way to ensure we have learning time versus testing time with our students here in Oregon. We need to develop, fund, and implement differentiated professional development for all educators and assessment users. And again, when we talk about assessment users, it's everyone. It's parents, students who should own their learning. It's policymakers to understand the work that happens in our school. And it's our community leaders who support public education here in Oregon. I'm extremely proud of our state educators and their commitment to ensuring that we develop a system of assessment that promotes student learning. I'm proud that we are being proactive. We are not content to sit back and work with a broken system or just say no. But we're focused on working collaboratively with other education leaders, parents, and our communities to ensure all of our students have access to the schools they deserve. We are well positioned, as I mentioned, to be one of the five states in the current form of the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act to create this system of assessment, to really lead the way in education the way that Oregon has led the way on many issues. A system that we produce needs to promote student learning and equity and put the love of learning back in our classrooms. I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to be with you here today, for your work to support a better system, and to ask you to work together with us to ensure that Oregon is truly leading in the way. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you have about the work we've done or the work moving forward to build this system.
Any questions? And so part of the assessment that you're developing, I know that you've got, there's the Wiggins Diggins, that the group of assessment people. Are you actually looking at developing the tests that would be necessary to meet the requirements from the federal government?
What we're looking, the assessments, not the summative assessment, I think we have to really examine, and that's what the feedback from the survey that we just produced, we're hoping that that will be used to make the changes that need to be made in the Smarter Balance. But the system that we're talking about is really focused on day-to-day learning. Educators do need to create the assessments that are used in their classroom every day. It makes a difference where you are and where your students are. The assessments that you use, if they don't really measure where your students are and help you know what the next steps are, then they aren't informing the instruction that our students deserve. So one of our recommendations is that we, as we provide professional development on assessment literacy, we'd also be creating assessments that there would be a bank across the state that could be utilized by educators anywhere in Oregon that are valid, reliable, and unbiased assessments. And it is a high bar. It's a high bar to set an assessment as unbiased. And that's something that we're concerned with the current summative assessment with Smarter Balance. But that would be our work in creating the ongoing formative assessments. And there are some interim assessments that's what educators were trained to do. The summative assessment, we need to work together and ensure that there is an assessment that measures the standards. And that's another critique of the Smarter Balance right now. We've adopted the Common Core State Standards, and in doing so, the Smarter Balance, it doesn't necessarily measure the standards to which we're held accountable. It measures buckets of standards. It doesn't give us feedback. As we just heard with the previous report on the SAT, we don't get information like that from the Smarter Balance. What we get is a score, and we get it after the kids have left our classrooms. It does not help. It does not help educators inform their instruction for each and every one of their students. It doesn't help parents. I really challenge anyone to think that you go to a parent-student conference and sit down and look at the number from the Smarter Balanced Assessment and that be the sole focus of the conversation. The focus is around where that child is in relation to all of the standards, and you don't get that information from the Smarter Balance. The assessment system that we're creating will be able to give information on those standards, and it will allow our students to have the time to learn, and it will inspire instead of give them that feeling of failure.
Any other questions for people? I want to thank you for coming here, but also for the work that's been going on for the last 18 months, because I know there's been a lot of it. I also hope that as we continue this road, that we'll engage more people into that conversation so that they feel comfortable, because I think there have been people who have felt, they're designing something, we don't know what's going on. And I don't get very nervous about that, because actually at the end of the day, the light will be shining on it, because you're going to talk to parents and everybody else. So getting the right thing is really important, and getting the right people to get the right thing trumps having too many people there. But my goal is that as we move forward, that we engage more and more people in understanding exactly what it is that we're trying to do with this formative assessment, so that they feel more comfortable, and parents start to understand that here we're doing something to help you and your child. It isn't a number that's going to tell you good, bad, or indifferent what you've done. It's a number that says, here's what you know, and here's what you need to know if you want to be successful in these kinds of things. And so that conversation needs to continue throughout the state as we figure out what we're going to do with that summative assessment, because that's a big question that I think our state has to answer. And most of us believe that there are times when you need that you know, it shouldn't destroy everything else when you're doing it, but you really do have to have that opportunity for people, whether they're outside the system, to be able to evaluate the system or wherever. And we need to have, at some point in this country, a way to say, compare state to state, compare district to district. All of those things are important. And I also think that you didn't mention it directly, that formative assessments and understanding where kids are is really a much better way to evaluate teachers and how they're working than a summative assessment that doesn't really give you enough information to evaluate individual students and parents and teachers, because it doesn't give you enough information to go back and say, here's what you missed, when you just have a score. So having conversations about all of that is really important, and I thank you for taking the time to present today.
Yes.
Just a comment. I still think, and I know this, I'm really old and this is really old-fashioned, I still think the work in the classroom should be the gold standard.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Chair Roblin, for your comments. And we have reached out. We've worked closely with PTA. We're working with COSA. We've had representatives from COSA and the Department of Ed. And we look forward to bringing everyone in, because for us to be successful, this is in Oregon, a new way. Right. And when the federal government gives us the opportunity to lead the way as one of those five states, we are going to run with it and truly have the schools that our students deserve. So thank you for your support.
Thank you. So, we have, I'll close that informational session. Next session, I would like to see if there's some bills that are going to come up. If individual people want to have conversations, let me know about the conversations they might want to have in our January meeting. Right now, we have a couple bills that I'm looking at for committee bills. One we've talked about was concussions and who can actually let a kid, a student, go back into play. We took out some people the last time, in fact, the naturopaths and the...
That's a pretty straightforward...
And the other people, oh, was one, I think, yeah.
Chiropractors?
Chiropractors, yeah. were left out, so we're going to do some things there. And then,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
That was a really good bill.
It was a really
so
good
my,
bill.
My daughter got a concussion at soccer practice the day before school started. She did not love the law because it meant it was much longer before she could go back to play. But her pediatrician was so happy with this change and indicated that she had a long line of coaches in her office wanting to know why she would not sign off on letting the kids play. So it really has delayed the return to play for kids, and I think that shows how important that legislation was.
We agree. I mean, making sure that the right people can do that is really important, and we'll have that conversation. As other things come up, we will have a bill on mascot, depending on what happens at the state level in January, but we know there will be a bill, so we'll have that probably be at least to talk about it. There may be some other things between now and then that get raised to that level, and we'll keep talking about it. Anything else that we have? Sarah's bill on fifth year.
Senator Gelser.
Senator Gelser. I'm sorry, I keep doing that. Okay. Senator
you can
Gelser.
Tell me anything you want.
Senator Gelser's bill that
that's
she's been working with her group,
okay.
And that we hope will be solidified, so we can have that kind of come up. That one come up as well. There is a work group that's starting this afternoon on the amount of resources given to charter schools, and is that appropriate? That may have a bill as well, so we'll let you know as we get closer. And if you have anything that you would like to highlight that you're introducing us in education, let me know. We can have some. We did have a talk already. So, again, with that, thank you, and we will adjourn our interim committee on education. Interim committee on education.